From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as we try to understand the latest news in the contested presidential election and the Florida recount, we examine some of the legal issues and precedents that are guiding the courts. We talk with Cass Sunstein, who teaches constitutional law at the University of Chicago. The courts and the contested election coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Vice President Al Gore said this evening he will accept the results of a Florida hand recount if his opponent, George W. Bush, will agree to allow a hand recount of ballots to finish in Palm Beach, Dade, and Broward counties in Florida. He also offered to accept a hand recount of all Florida counties if Bush agrees to that. Gore urged both Republicans and Democrats to refrain from inflammatory language as the dispute over the election result is resolved.
We should both call on all our supporters to prepare themselves to close ranks as Americans and unite the country behind the winner as soon as this process is completed.
The vice president proposed that he and Governor Bush meet one-to-one to improve the tone of their dialogue. Florida's highest court has rejected the Republican Secretary of State's lawsuit to delay the manual recounting of ballots cast in last week's election. Susan Gage of Florida Public Radio reports.
The Florida Supreme Court has said the counties wishing to do a manual recount may do so. The High Court has also turned down Secretary of State Catherine Harris's request to consolidate all the lawsuits into one suit in the Leon County Circuit Court. The justice's one-page opinion did not get into the other election-related lawsuits currently before some of the circuit courts in the state. This unanimous opinion comes from a 7-member Supreme Court, 6 of whom were appointed by Democratic governors and one joint appointee of the late Governor Lawton Chiles and current Governor Jeb Bush. Meanwhile, the campaign of Texas Governor George W. Bush has filed a federal lawsuit with the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta to block the manual recounts in Florida. For NPR News, I'm Susan Gage in Tallahassee.
Los Angeles police officers were found guilty today of conspiracy to obstruct justice in the first trial in the so-called Rampart corruption scandal. A fourth defendant was acquitted. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
The charges related to two separate incidents in 1996. In one, prosecutors alleged that the officers had planted a gun on a suspect. The jury acquitted all four defendants on those charges. But the jury found that in the second incident, officers Michael Buchanan and Brian Liddy committed perjury when they said that two gang members intentionally drove a truck into them. In addition, Sergeant Edward Ortiz was convicted for corroborating their false story. Prosecutors had to make their case without the aid of their star witness, former officer Rafael Perez. He told authorities of widespread corruption in the Rampart anti-gang unit in exchange for a lighter sentence on a drug charge. But during the trial, Perez was under investigation for murder, and he said he'd plead the fifth if called to the stand. His accuser, a former girlfriend, recanted her story after the jury began deliberations. Ina Jaffe, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The Dow Jones Industrials closed up by 26 today at 10,707. The Nasdaq was up 27 points at 3165. This is NPR News. A study in this week's New England Journal of Medicine presents worrisome findings for Medicare patients following a heart attack. As NPR's Patricia Naimond reports, patients in managed health care plans were less likely to receive life-saving diagnostic tests.
An angiogram is essentially an X-ray of the heart that helps identify areas where arteries are blocked and helps doctors figure out whether patients need further interventions like bypass surgery. Researchers from Harvard Medical School analyzed patient records for over 50,000 Medicare beneficiaries. They looked at patients who needed an angiogram based on standards issued by the American Heart Association. They found patients in managed care health plans were 20% less likely to receive receive one than those in traditional health plans. But even among those in traditional plans, not even half of patients received the needed tests. Researchers say both doctors and patients need to be more aware of the value of angiograms following heart attacks. Patricia Naimond, NPR News, Los Angeles.
American Roman Catholic bishops have called for sweeping changes in the criminal justice system, and they've denounced the Supreme Court's rejection of a ban on some late-term abortions. At its annual meeting in Washington, the National Conference of Catholic Bishops said the Supreme Court has brought the legal system to the brink of endorsing infanticide. The bishops also reaffirmed their opposition to the death penalty. Drug maker Eli Lilly said today it has received a 6-month extension to be the only company marketing its popular antidepressant Prozac. Lilly said it wanted the extension to do further research on the drug's effects on children. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today was filled with more news about suits, countersuits, and appeals surrounding the presidential election. The day began with Florida's Secretary of State, Katherine Harris, petitioning the state Supreme Court to consolidate in one state court all the legal decisions surrounding the contested election. By the end of the day, the state Supreme Court had denied that request, as well as her request to delay any hand counting of ballots. A federal appeals court has agreed to consider the Bush campaign's request to stop manual recounts in Florida. This evening, Al Gore said that we should complete the hand counts, and if we do, he would abide by the results and not take legal action to challenge them. He would also agree to hand counts in all the counties of Florida. We invited Cass Sunstein to discuss some of the legal background and precedents that can help us understand the news. Sunstein is a professor at the University of Chicago, where he teaches constitutional law. I spoke with him early this morning and asked why the legal battles are mostly in the state courts, even though this is a national election.
If there's a constitutional question, like if someone's constitutional rights are being violated, or if there's an issue of ordinary federal law, like if someone's civil rights are being violated, then the federal court would get involved. Or if there's a question about the interpretation of federal law governing who's going to be the president, then a federal court would get involved. But at this stage in Florida, all the issues have to do with how we count votes in Florida. In a way, it's funny because they're kind of local, small issues of Florida law. And in a way, it's kind of wonderful because this shows federalism in action. Under federal law, the determination of how a state has gone is really a matter of state law, which is how the founders of the Constitution intended it to be. So there are some federal issues in the picture. But none of them are really being pressed by either camp within Florida courts. The issue is, how do you count votes, and what is the role of the manual recount? And what about the claim that these ballots aren't good because people can't understand them? There aren't federal laws that govern any of those questions. They're all matters of state law.
But some individuals might say that their federal rights have been denied because they voted, and yet the vote isn't getting registered. Might that become a suit that goes to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, we could imagine a few federal cases that would get to the Supreme Court. I think they're pretty unlikely to succeed. But one claim that Governor Bush is making is a federal issue that could possibly go to the Supreme Court. He's claiming that the system of manual recounts is so arbitrary and random that it violates his own constitutional rights. And that's what he argued in a federal court in trying to stop the manual recounts. Now, since manual recounts aren't the most unusual thing in the world, it's hard to say that even a somewhat arbitrary system of manual recounts violates Governor Bush's constitutional rights. Now, some people claim that they were denied the right to vote on the basis of their skin color, and some people are claiming that. Then that is potentially a federal issue that could go to the Supreme Court. On the facts that have come out thus far, you can understand why people are making this claim, but the evidence probably isn't at this stage good enough to make for, you know, a real demonstration that people were excluded from the vote because of their skin color. There are other people who could make a federal claim that because the ballot is so nutty and impossible to follow, that their federal constitutional rights to vote have been compromised, as you say. That's the third of the set of federal issues I'm discussing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that one might sound complicated. It's pretty simple. If a state, let's say Massachusetts, gave a ballot that was so confusing that people thought they were voting for Gore, but they were actually voting for Bush or Buchanan, there would be a good federal constitutional claim that their rights had been violated. Here, it's unlikely that that rises to that level, and this is the reason. It is a pretty confusing ballot, but by all accounts, over 90% of people could understand it. And the fact that a minority, not trivial and not racial, you know, a minority of people couldn't understand it, doesn't make for a constitutional violation. The Supreme Court's been pretty clear that confusion by voters is not a federal constitutional violation. The real problem is not that the voters' constitutional rights have been violated. The real problem is that their state law rights might have been violated because state law seems to require that the will of the people be expressed through the ballot procedure, and it's not clear that that's happened.
Well, another federal constitutional question, say several people file suits saying that these ballots discriminate against the elderly because the elderly, many of them can't see as clearly, maybe they have arthritis, they can't punch the card as well. Would that be a case?
Probably not. If it's the case that older people have trouble understanding something because they're, and we're talking about generalizations here, not every older person, partly because they're slower or their eyes don't work quite so well, a ballot that is harder for them than for younger people or people who are faster or have better eyesight, that isn't a federal constitutional problem. I mean, if you had a law that said older people can't vote or older people have to take a slow train to the ballot box if it explicitly discriminated against older people, then there'd probably be a problem. But if it's a ballot that's more confusing to older people than to younger people, I don't think we have to worry much about a federal constitutional violation.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Cass Sunstein. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago, where he teaches constitutional law. Now, several judges on the lower level have recused themselves because of party affiliation. How is the state Supreme Court chosen, and what are the odds that the people on the state Supreme Court will be partisan and recuse themselves?
The governor appoints the members of the Florida State Supreme Court, and in Florida, they're almost all, there's one kind of mixed case, but they're almost all Democratic appointees. None of them is a partisan person who's been involved in any way in the Bush-Gore election. So the likelihood that the state Supreme Court justices will have to recuse themselves is pretty low.
So historically, voting has been a state law issue. And as we can see in this election, states have different laws and different ballots and different styles of voting. Why is it historically that voting is a state issue and not a federal issue? Why is it that the laws vary from state to state, and even the mechanisms for voting vary from state to state?
Well, it's partly just out of respect for our federal system. And one of the really great things about this not-so-great tie is that people are focusing on what our system of democracy is really about and how we might want to change it if we want to. The old understanding, which is the current one, though it may be changed in the next few years, is that the national government should get involved only when it really needs to. And that's why we have pollution laws and national defense at the federal level. But that when there's no special need for national involvement, then states can make their own choices so long as they don't violate the Constitution. Now, it's pretty complicated to have the center, as this is the sort of thing Republicans reasonably say, to have the center settling things for all of the states, especially because local circumstances are different. So if Florida wants to have one system and New York wants to have a somewhat different system, our normal thought is that these are well adapted, we hope, to the situation of the different populations. You might think Nebraska doesn't have to have the same voting system as New York just because the needs are different. It's less crowded. You might want to have special rules for New York or Nebraska. And so Florida has its own particular concerns, growing undoubtedly out of the fact that There's a large immigrant population and a large elderly population, and the rules that are well suited to Florida probably aren't perfectly suited to California or Idaho.
Do you think that this crazy election is going to lead to reconsideration of certain state voting laws or lead for a national campaign of reform in election law to make things more standard?
I do think we'll see that, and there are a couple of things to keep in mind. One is the system really isn't broken. We've had a statistical tie, basically, and it's very odd. It hasn't happened anything like this for 100 years. So we ought not, I think, to overreact to a particular real anomaly. On the other hand, I think one problem has been uncovered that is worth addressing, which is that our system for counting ballots is not only not uniform, it's pretty antiquated. So I'm sure a lot of people listening, like probably the two of us, went into booths that weren't really high tech. And, you know, they say if you can put a man on the moon, you ought to be able to have a pretty simple high-tech voting system. We have an old one that's full of error, not because of fraud or anything like that, but just because of randomness. And I wouldn't be at all surprised to see a real movement for greater uniformity and greater modernness. We should see modernization of the voting booth.
My guest is Cass Sunstein. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Cass Sunstein. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. Both the Democrats and Republicans have been challenging decisions in the courts. At the very beginning of the election result process, everybody was saying it's really important to try to keep the election out of the courts. Why do so many people think it's important to try to keep the election out of the courts?
Well, I think there are two things. Some people think that judges are not politically accountable and that we don't want them to decide who our president is, so they really don't trust judicial neutrality. And other people think that this is a recipe for endless delay and maneuvering and strategizing. They're two really different complaints, and they're easy to understand. I don't think that we should be as worried as we've been about getting things into the courts. And the fact that we shouldn't worry about that so much is kind of proved by the interest of both Governor Bush and Vice President Gore in using courts, not to get courts to choose the president that the court likes, but to get the courts to settle legal issues, to make sure the election was lawful. If we're worried about delay, and we ought to be, the Florida courts are already showing they're going to do this really fast. They're making decisions as rapidly as possible, often within a day. And if we're worried about judicial bias, I think the role of the judge is a pretty good insulation against bias. And the Florida law isn't as open-ended as you might think, so when there's a challenge brought, there are often words and precedents that discipline the judge's decision. So people don't like delay, and they don't like judges making their own value judgments. But in Florida, I think those are overrated concerns.
Can you give us an example where you think precedent disciplined the judge's decision?
Well, the big issue raised by many voters is whether the ballots are, the butterfly ballots are too confusing, and therefore require the election to be voided. Now, under the Florida precedent, you can void an election, but only under really rare circumstances where the will of the people has been thwarted because of some violation of the law. Now, that basic framework gets you, 90% of the way home. The question is the will of the people been thwarted in Florida? And there you have to investigate the facts to see. And then you have to ask whether the statute's been violated, and the statute has some criteria to test whether there's been a violation. And then you have to ask whether it's appropriate for the court to void the election. And the court has suggested a strong presumption against doing that. The court doesn't like voiding elections. And with all that material there, I don't think it matters a whole lot whether there's a Democratic judge or a Republican judge. On this particular issue, the butterfly ballot, the precedent suggests it's a real uphill battle for those who are challenging their votes. But if they can show that a large number of people were really confused and that's what made the difference, then Governor Bush is going to have a problem.
Now, there was that issue whether the ballot, the butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County was illegal because the law says that the punch has to be to the right of the candidate's name, whereas the punch was to the left of several candidates' names, including Pat Buchanan. And a lot of people claim that they meant to vote for the Gore-Lieberman ticket and instead voted for Buchanan because of that confusing placement of the punch.
The butterfly ballot has prompted two complaints. One is that that it wasn't on the right of everybody's name, which Florida law seems to require, though that's not entirely clear. And the other dispute is that people couldn't understand it, and so the will of the people was thwarted, which is a separate basis for challenging the butterfly ballot. These recounts have nothing to do with the butterfly ballot, and what is thought is that machines are imperfect, and sometimes they won't pick up votes that are real because the punch didn't go completely right, but the naked eye can get it really well. And so I think the Gore strategy right now is to see if a manual recount can put them over the top even without challenging the ballot. Then the ballot issue is moot.
But so do you think that the ballot issue can't come into play anymore, or that it still might come into play?
Well, it's a great question. The Gore has several legal strategies, and I think he's aware that the American people are going to run out of patience pretty soon. So he's not going to get many bites at the apple. There, if he loses on the recount, which he might, we don't know, and if the absentee ballots don't come out his way, then he has a choice whether to mount a separate legal challenge to the butterfly ballot. Now, in a way, that choice has already been made by voters who are not allied with Vice President Gore, who have brought their own separate challenges to the butterfly ballot. But there is a separate suit by voters in Palm Beach County contending that they couldn't understand the ballot and contending also that the names weren't all to the right. The punch place wasn't all to the right of the names, and so that the ballot is an illegal ballot. That is not a ridiculous claim under the Florida precedents, and I think if Gore doesn't win on the recount and the absentees, which we'll know by Friday or Saturday, then he's got a really tough kind of political legal call, which is whether to participate in the challenge to the ballot. What's significant is that the legal challenge to the ballot isn't bad. As a matter of Florida law, there's support for it if he can show on the facts that a lot of people were confused by it. Is it a winner? A hunch is probably not, but that's a very tentative hunch.
One possible remedy if that ballot was found to be illegal would be, say, another election in that county. And it seems that law and opinion in this country is very biased against a second election. What are some of the precedents that oppose a second election?
Well, the Florida court has given clear indication that second elections can be required in circumstances where the will of the people is thwarted. It hasn't happened much in the history of the country, but it has happened in the face of, you know, real violations and unreliability, at least once in recent years, not in Florida. I think the reason the court wouldn't do it is that to get a more accurate count through a new election than what we have through this messy process we've ended is very unlikely. With the new election, it's kind of the stuff of science fiction. You're trying to reproduce a situation that went wrong because of bad ballots. But time has changed, and how to get this to be reliable is a real mess. I mean, for one thing, who's going to be allowed to vote? Is it just the people who voted originally, or is it everyone? If it's everyone, then you'll get all sorts of new voters, which will produce really legitimate complaints, especially from Governor Bush. If it's everyone who voted and no one else, then there's going to be at least a bit of a mess to make sure that no one's there who wasn't there before. And also, the conditions are different. The Nader voters might well say, well, I'm going to vote for Bush. I'm going to vote for Gore, maybe. Bush, maybe if the ballot's bad, they'll get confused again. But the Nader people are highly likely to vote for Gore, and that will mess things up from the standpoint of trying to replicate the conditions of the first one without the bad ballot, which is what the judge would be after. So I think new elections are a bit of a nightmare and unlikely in the extreme.
What about just saying this is a runoff election? We're not trying to duplicate the first election. That would be too difficult to do. So this is a runoff election.
The judge would have to be really convinced that the ballot was a horrible ballot and that so many people were confused that the outcome is unreliable. I think the judge, you know, judges are, because of their role, somewhat neutral and a little bit unlike most human beings, but they would know that this would be a circus. So a runoff election for the president of the United States in one relatively small area in Florida, it's just awfully crazy. And because judges have discretion, once they've found an illegal ballot, to weigh all appropriate considerations and figure out what the right response is, a new election wouldn't be as shocking as what's happened. So one should never say never. What's happened is as surprising as anything. But it would be really surprising.
Cass Sunstein teaches constitutional law at the University of Chicago. Our interview was recorded this morning. We'll hear more from Sunstein in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Watson Wyatt Worldwide, creators of the Human Capital Index, to measure the value of human resources, on the web at watsonwyatt.com. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, legal precedents pertaining to manual recounts. We continue our talk about the election and the courts with constitutional law expert Cass Sunstein. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's continue our conversation about the courts and the contested election with Cass Sunstein. He's a professor at the University of Chicago, where he teaches constitutional law. Our conversation was recorded this morning. Let's look at the controversy over hand counts. And I say the controversy. There's many controversies pertaining to the hand counts. Let's start with the one about when it's appropriate to do a hand count. What kind of precedent are we looking at here, constitutionally and on a statewide level?
Well, there's no constitutional rules on hand counts as a matter of federal law. All this is really left to the states. And I can tell you what Florida seems to think through its laws. Florida seems to like hand counts. It seems to think that manual counts are more reliable than machines. And so the Florida law says if the people in charge, the canvassing commission, think that there's a problem, they can do a hand count. And that's why they're doing it. So as a matter of Florida law, we know Florida law likes hand counts, thinks they're more reliable. The problem is what Governor Bush is rightly concerned about, that any hand count is going to pick up more votes than the computer did, just because you can inspect by the eye and find things that the computer couldn't. And if you restrict the hand count to areas where Gore was really popular, you're going to have a big inflation of Gore votes in a way that might not produce real accuracy because you didn't do hand counts in areas in which Bush was really popular. Now, Bush is kind of stuck on that because he didn't ask for hand counts in the required time. But I think he's afraid if you do selective hand counts, you may end up with a less accurate outcome than before because you find these new Gore votes, but you didn't search and look for new Bush votes by looking in the other areas. And so a selective hand count has a lot of problems. On the other hand, under Florida law, the selective hand count is entirely legitimate.
Now, the Republicans are saying that hand counts in Florida with the system that they have are too subjective, they're not fair and accurate. Has that been an issue in previous elections?
No. Here we're now really on a new question, and it's a good, hard question, which is the advantages and disadvantages of hand counts. I think Governor Bush is, in a way, overstating it. He has a point, but it's a little more hysterical in how it's being presented than reality bears out. The fair point is that a hand count can be inaccurate, both because of subjectivity and bias. These are human beings who are prone to mistake and maybe have a political interest. And also, he's saying that it may be that if you touch the ballots a lot, you'll start pushing things out just by accident. So the ballot won't look exactly like the voter did it once you're handling it. Now, these are probably overstated concerns because it's not easy, unless you have long fingernails and are really malicious, to alter a ballot to look exactly like you want it to when someone else has already marked it up. I think the real concern is not the bias issue or the error issue. It's the selectivity of the recount. That's what the problem Bush is concerned with is. On the other hand, there really aren't precedents that support Bush's objection here. And while Florida hasn't litigated this, we don't have court decisions on it, the Florida state law seems to suggest manual counts are better than machine counts. Now, what's messing this up is the Secretary of State wants to get this over with pretty quickly. So there's a conflict between the Secretary of State, who wants a rapid end, and the more local areas who want to get accurate hand counts.
Is a machine any more or less subjective than human beings in this kind of card punch type of system? For example, I think a lot of people have experienced this. If you have a dollar bill and you're trying to put it in one of those change machines or trying to get use one of those dollar machines to get a ticket for, like, the train, like some cities have, some of those dollars are old and they won't be accepted by the machine. You can buy anything with that dollar. It is inarguably a dollar, but the machine might still reject it.
It is terrible. Happened to me just yesterday. That's a really good analogy. If you want a candy bar, sometimes the machine will not believe your dollar is a dollar, even if you try hard to stick it in there. And that's exactly what's happening here. The machines often, well, at least in enough percentage of cases to make a difference, possibly. The machines won't accept it, even though it's real. What we should think is that there are two kinds of mistakes. One is the mistake from the machine's failure to recognize the ballot, and we've already got numbers suggesting that happened. And then the other error is from human error, which I would think would be much more likely to be mistake than bias, though it's possible there's going to be bias too. So no system is perfect. And we haven't had to worry about the imperfections in our system because our elections haven't been so, you know, incredibly close before. The Florida law seems to like hand counts better than machines. It seems to make the judgment that hand counts are more accurate than machines. In the abstract, we'd have to know a lot about their machines and their hand counters to know. If some people think, as some of the Bush people are saying, that machines just are more accurate than hand counts, you know, they don't know enough to say that. If Gore people are saying hand counts are just more accurate than machines, they don't know enough to say that either. Gore has the better argument on Florida law, but we have to know a lot about the counters and the machines to know who's right on the facts.
What kind of legal precedent do we have to help guide in the decision of how swinging chads and hanging chads and pregnant chads and all of that should be considered in a hand count?
With respect to the chads, which is the new popular word, maybe many boys and girls will find themselves named Chad as a result of this, at least boys, legal precedents are really thin. I don't think there's anything in Florida law that says how you handle these chads. It's just a matter of kind of common sense if you can see that someone made a punch. And there is a degree of subjectivity there. If you have good counters who aren't biased, it's not all that complicated to see whether the punch was made or not. So I don't think it's really more a kind of question of fact, what the thing looks like, than a question of law, though you could have legal limitations on what individual judgments would be made. This is a really tiny legal question, so tiny it's never been litigated, but the presidency of the United States may turn on it.
Any other thoughts that you have that we should keep in mind as we follow the whole Chad drama as it unfolds?
Well, what I would watch for is acts of warfare on the one hand or statesmanship on the other by both sides. So far, the two have been really entrenched and increasingly entrenched in a way as the legal teams take over. And we've had kind of few statements by either side indicating what some of their behavior seems to indicate, which is a commitment by both to getting this over quickly, to trying to unify the country once it's over quickly, to resting as much as possible on good faith interpretations of Florida law. It's really important to know that thus far the Gore position has been extremely reasonable as a matter of law and politics. And the Bush people ought to acknowledge that. What Gore has been doing has not been stretching the law. It hasn't been stretching out time. It's really reasonable. What the Gore people ought to acknowledge, and haven't yet, is that the Bush people's legal position is equally reasonable. We have people who aren't really pushing hard in terms of making frivolous legal arguments or dumb legal arguments or self-serving legal arguments. Both sides are acting in quite reasonably and in real good faith in terms of their behavior. The disturbing thing is neither side has acknowledged that point about the other. In fact, in some of their rhetoric, they've denied it. And the country would be better off to say, you know, we have a dispute on Florida law. We're both proceeding in good faith. And the larger interests of the country are what's really important. And when this is over, I will pledge and hope my supporters will pledge full support to the person who's elected.
My guest is Cass Sunstein. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Let's get back to the conversation we recorded this morning with Cass Sunstein, a law professor at the University of Chicago. As a lawyer and constitutional expert, are you upset to see the election in the courts, and how do you feel about all the lawyers who are converging on Florida now?
I don't think it should be so upsetting that it's in the courts, because what the courts are really doing is to apply the law enacted by the people. So the courts, I think, are getting a kind of bad rap in this. They're not making things up. They're trying the best they can do with the law. If this was a case where, you know, the law was violated and the election was no good, then thank goodness we have courts and law to protect us. I think the sheer numbers of lawyers in Florida is a little disturbing, because, you know, we don't want this to be something where the American people feel that specialists are taking over their democracy. So that's a bit of a problem. I think lawyers are under obligation to explain that this is, you know, there's a lot of jargon going on here, but a lot of it is really applied common sense.
Are there any other possible suits that we haven't already addressed that you see coming up before this is over?
Well, one thing to watch for is whether there's a federal civil rights action that really gets off the ground, alleging that people were deprived of the vote in general because of the confusing ballot, or deprived of the vote on the basis of skin color, because that's high fireworks. That's really heavy artillery. On what's been reported so far, those lawsuits aren't likely to succeed, but they're likely to produce a lot of noise if they're brought.
My guest is Cass Sunstein. He's an expert in constitutional law, and he's a law professor at the University of Chicago. Do you think that we're in the middle of a constitutional crisis now?
No. We are in the middle of an extremely complicated and intricate set of problems, but we're not in a constitutional crisis because we have peace and stability and a well-functioning democracy and two candidates who are really committed to the process. We are in a constitutional crisis only in the sense that we have unsettled issues that have a constitutional kind of feature. So no one should call this a crisis or an emergency. The State of the Union is good. We have two presidential candidates who have, you know, a high degree of popular support. They got more votes than Clinton did the first time around, both of them. So I don't think there's anything really to worry about, though we do have, you know, some time to go before we get all this settled. It's a constitutional crisis in a way in the technical sense, but not in the sense that should concern anybody. It's very different from the impeachment controversy, for example, where there was a real risk that something very major and destructive would happen.
On the question of whether the American public will recognize the legitimacy of the next president, if it goes the Republican way, do you think that Democrats would feel more strongly than Republicans would if it went the Democratic way, because the Republicans actually succeeded in impeaching a Democratic president, and this is coming on the heels of that?
I think it's possible that the impeachment issue is in a way being replayed in this, and some of the very bad feelings on both sides are fueling this, where the Democrats think that there was an attempted coup in the impeachment proceeding, and they think that this effort to close down the vote prematurely before they've been counted has a coup-like feature. Whereas the Bush people think that, some of them think, that the Democrats are untrustworthy and manipulative and strategic and morally challenged, and that what we need is to have a process that is committed to the rule of law, which was the line during the impeachment process and which is the line now. Now, the impeachment thing, I think, was quite destructive, and there was a villain. And the villain was not Kenneth Starr, I don't think, but it was the Republican managers who violated the Constitution. But, you know, bygones should be bygones, and they're good people, I think, who made a terrible mistake. Here there really is no villain. Bush and his people are acting just fine, and so are Gore and his people. But I think you're right that some of the ill feeling is spilled from the impeachment and other conflicts is spilling over. That really maybe is the longer-term danger. I'm not sure the Gore people, because of impeachment, would be more aggrieved if they lost than the Bush people would be if they lost. Both sides are talking about how the election is being stolen by the other side. I think we should end that rhetoric. No one's trying to steal anything. Jeb Bush has admirably recused himself. There's no reason to distrust the Florida process. And the rhetoric really should be cooled. I do think the long-term concern is that the Bush people, if Gore is the president, will think it's an illegitimate Clintonian in the worst sense presidency. And the Gore people, if Bush is elected, will think they didn't let the people vote.
Are you worried about any possible permanent damage to institutions caused as a result of this prolonged election and all the lawsuits, et cetera?
I think the real damage that's possible is to the American public's faith in the legitimacy of the president for the next 4 years. And if that becomes a serious problem, the person to blame will be the losing candidate, whether it's Bush or Gore. So what I think from the standpoint of kind of the constitutional system generally, what's worth worrying over is the risk of what Alexander Hamilton described as tumult and disorder. Hamilton thought the Electoral College was great, as great as anything in the Constitution, because it would prevent what he hated most, tumult and disorder. There's a risk of tumult and disorder, and the reason is that neither candidate is acknowledging the reasonableness and good faith of the other side. What Vice President Gore really should do in the next few days is to say, I, like my adversary, am committed to this process. We are disagreeing on issues of Florida law and maybe some others, but we're not disagreeing on any issue of large principle. We're both committed to the Electoral College. We basically tied, and I think he's acting in completely honorably, notwithstanding our disagreements. And instead of saying, we won, we won, we won, we won, which is what George Bush's campaign manager has said, George W. Bush should say, you know, we have some unsettled issues here in Florida, and I'm properly not starting a transition. That's too early for that. I am pressing my view of the law, but I'm committed to the process, too. And I understand that Vice President Gore is acting reasonably in good faith, despite our disagreements. And if I lose, I will pledge my support to him with enthusiasm.
My guest is Cass Sunstein. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the conversation we recorded this morning with Cass Sunstein, a law professor at the University of Chicago. Now, you've said that the Electoral College was originally a place for people to deliberate about who the next president should be, as opposed to the way we think of it now. You kind of vote the way your state went, period.
Right. That's a neglected topic that tells us a lot about our constitutional system. There was a debate in the Constitutional Convention about whether the president should be elected by the legislature or instead by the people. and the legislature was rejected on the ground that that would make the president too dependent on the legislature because he would owe his job to them. The people were rejected on the ground that, you know, back then it was hard to get communication transferred quickly. So the idea is people wouldn't know who was good, and so they could be manipulated by artful people. The Electoral College was the compromise that they were really proud of, by which people would vote for electors, and you'd know the electors because they were your neighbors, and then the electors would all get together and deliberate with each other, exchange opinions, and they'd be good people, sensible people, and they'd choose the right president. What is kind of important for the long run about this is that framers wanted to create a certain kind of democracy that is not one that would depend on like snapshots of popular opinion, but which would have a lot of deliberation in it. So the Electoral College was supposed to be a deliberative body, just like the Senate was supposed to be a deliberative body, where you wouldn't just do what the people wanted. You'd listen carefully to it, but you'd do what was right. And that's maybe a large lesson for both of the candidates to keep in mind. Even if the Electoral College as a deliberative body is kind of an anachronism, people don't know who the electors were. They know who the candidates were. Even if it's an anachronism, it has a kind of long lesson about not just reacting to pressures and snapshots, but also to taking the longer view and exchanging views with people who disagree with you.
When did it change from deliberative to just vote what the voter said you should vote?
Pretty quickly. Within about 20 years, the electors were following the voters' will rather than deliberating. I think the key difference was that political parties weren't around at the time of the framing, but they came up shortly after the framing. And once political parties were in place, the electors were kind of party people, and then they just follow the victorious party. In fact, there was a constitutional challenge to a state law provision which required electors to pledge that they'd support the candidate that the people voted for as a condition for being electors. So what some states have done is to take steps to ensure that electors won't deliberate, that they'll do just what the voters said. That was challenged in the Supreme Court, and a divided court said that the parties could require the electors just to go along with what the voters said, and the Constitution did not require that they be allowed to deliberate. And in upholding the law, which maybe they shouldn't have done, they said that the practice, as you say, has shifted over the years toward just following what the people say. And if the state law wants to insist on maintaining that practice, the state's allowed to do that. And it really, you know, the practice of deliberation broke down pretty early, and we haven't seen it for many decades.
You're a constitutional scholar. Do you think we should be looking to either reform or do away with the Electoral College system?
I'm not sure. I think probably we're not going to, because the Electoral College favors small states. And since you need a supermajority of the states to amend the Constitution, the small states have the power and probably would exercise it to block changes in the Electoral College. I will say one thing, which is that the Electoral College has been defended a lot in recent days as a way of ensuring that states get attention that would otherwise be neglected, states with small populations. It's not clear that's a good argument, because if we have popular vote, then people, as people, get paid attention, depending on where the numbers are. And it's not clear that people, just because they happen to be in, let's say, Nebraska or Idaho, deserve more attention because they're in a small state than equal numbers of people who live in California or Illinois or New York. So it does protect small states, but if you think that what you really are concerned about is people and not where people live, it's not clear that the disproportionate power of small states can be justified.
Cass Sunstein, what lessons would you like us to be learning about the Constitution as we so closely monitor what's happening in the election?
I think the large lesson is the amazing stability of the American electoral process in the face of a real test where both sides are going within the legal forms, where the space that the Constitution places between the vote and the inauguration proves to be very wise, the kind of stability of the system, which is committed entirely, and all participants are committed to the rule of law, is really quite remarkable under this test. So I think this is, you know, far from showing that the Constitution needs to be fixed. This shows that even under the most severe and weird circumstances, it's basically working.
Cass Sunstein, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Cass Sunstein is a law professor at the University of Chicago. Our interview was recorded this morning. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers today were Al Banks and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Division, publisher of In Our Time by Susan Brown Miller, a memoir of the feminist revolution. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The CIA has just released thousands of secret documents detailing their covert operation in Chile to destabilize the government of Salvador Allende. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive. He led the effort to get the documents released. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.